Hello, I'm Dr. James Campbell, and today's talk is on global public health and security. There are numerous security-related health challenges for humans in the Indo-Asia-Pacific region. The first is infectious diseases, and the second is non-communicable diseases, or NCDs. The infectious diseases comprise pandemic disease, emerging or re-emerging infectious diseases, and the specter of bioterrorism. The non-communicable diseases are basically diseases of obesity, such as diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and stroke. In this presentation, I'll be focusing primarily on infectious diseases. This graph is intended to show several threats to the health of humans. On the vertical axis is the likelihood of occurrence of such a threat. On the horizontal axis is the magnitude of harm of such a threat if it were to happen. So if you look first in the upper left, you see explosives. Explosives are quite likely to occur. They occur every day in many parts of the world. However, unless you're in very close proximity to the explosion, the magnitude of harm would be quite small. On the other hand, in the upper right, you see natural disasters, such as cyclones, tsunamis. These, the likelihood of occurrence is quite high. We all know they occur every year. They will continue to happen every year. And when they do occur, the magnitude of harm is generally large. Then I'd like to call your attention to the lower left, what I've termed bioagents. Bioagents are bioterrorism agents intended to inflict harm on human beings. I judge the likelihood of occurrence of a bioagent is actually quite small. The reason is that bioagents are difficult to produce. They're dangerous to the person who would produce them. They're very difficult to distribute effectively, and they're also very difficult to maintain security in such an operation. So the likelihood of occurrence is relatively small. And the magnitude of harm I also judge as small, because for a bioterrorism agent to be effective, it must be able to be transmitted easily between people. And most infectious agents that would be tried will not transmit easily between people. So the likelihood of occurrence is low, the magnitude of harm is low for a biological agent. On the other hand, if you look to the far right of the chart, you see the sort of faded out bioagent symbol. I term bio by Mother Nature. And by this I mean pandemic disease, emerging infectious disease. A large pandemic, I judge the likelihood of occurrence as being relatively low, because a global pandemic has many, many constraints on it. So to actually have a large global pandemic doesn't occur very often. However, should it occur, the consequences could be greater than anything else we've experienced. To begin talking about global public health security, let's look at a definition of global public health security. Global public health security minimizes vulnerability to acute public health events that endanger the collective health of populations living across geographical regions and international boundaries. And importantly, it includes the impact on economic, political stability, trade, tourism, access to goods and services, and demographic stability. So global public health security has a health component, but it also has an economic component. When there is a health security event, nations take action to respond. Some of these response measures can include isolation and quarantine. You may have heard these terms, and they may have been used interchangeably when in fact they are not the same. Isolation refers to taking people who are ill, displaying symptoms of illness, and putting them in a room with restricted access so that they cannot infect other people. Quarantine is people who have been exposed to sick people, but who are not themselves sick, at least not yet. But because they have been exposed and they may become sick, they also are put in rooms with limited access so they cannot expose other people, and so they can be monitored for disease. So isolation and quarantine are different. Isolation is for sick people. Quarantine is for healthy people who have been exposed to sick people. In addition, nations may impose travel restrictions if they have an outbreak of infectious disease. They may close their borders for traffic into or out of their country, or both directions. When countries do this, however, it's important that they balance public health risk and the rights of individuals, and the impact of the response measures on the welfare of the countries with infectious disease outbreaks. Because when you impose some of these measures, you can seriously impact people's rights and their livelihoods. In addition, countries must reconcile domestic versus international public health responsibilities. And by this I mean domestic responsibilities. A minister of health's primary responsibility is to the health and well-being of the people in his or her country. However, they also have a responsibility to their neighbors to ensure that the disease does not spread across international borders. So there are two levels of responsibility in health security. And finally, when countries decide they must impose public health interventions to protect the public health, they must use the least restrictive means necessary to accomplish this goal. This slide is intended to discuss the challenges of H5N1 or bird flu given local practices. So on the upper left, you see a picture that has a cage with birds of different species, ducks, chickens, geese, all in the same cage together. And this is intended to show that these birds can transmit the disease between birds of different species. In fact, virtually any bird can contract bird flu. In the bottom panel, you see a situation where wild birds could potentially come in contact with domestic birds in cages, and the wild birds could transmit disease to the domestic birds, or the domestic birds could transmit the disease to the wild birds, which could then fly to another location and infect other birds. And the last slide talks about the fact that in many countries in the Indo-Asia-Pacific region, people live in very close association with their animals. And this picture shows people actually sleeping in the chicken coop with their animals. The H5N1 bird flu transmits from birds to people. Now, if there is a good side to this, it's the fact that it is actually quite difficult for the birds to transmit the disease to people. It does not transmit easily to the people. And moreover, and more importantly, the disease does not transmit easily between people. So with H5N1 bird flu, it's actually difficult to catch the disease. It's actually difficult to spread between people. The problem is, if you are unfortunate enough to catch the disease, you're probably going to die, because about 60% of the people or more who contract H5N1 bird flu die. So to summarize, bird flu is difficult to transmit between people, but it's highly lethal. I highlight that to contrast bird flu with this next one, which is the swine flu, which probably most of you have heard of. This is H1N1 swine flu, first detected in America, in the United States, in 2009. Characteristics of the swine flu was that it transmits between people very, very easily, which is in sharp contrast to the bird flu, which, as you may recall, I said, transmits very poorly between humans. So the swine flu transmits very easily between people. However, swine flu is actually a very mild disease. So you can see that there's very distinct contrast between these two. Bird flu, difficult to transmit between people, highly lethal. Swine flu transmits easily between people, very mild disease. There have been some large outbreaks of H1N1 around the world, notably in 2009, H1N1 swine flu became a global pandemic. It was actually declared by the World Health Organization as a global pandemic. It was in every continent on the earth. What came out of that, some of the lessons learned, was that the public needs to know what's going on. Providing clear, timely information to the public is essential. The other observation was that several countries decided to try to interrupt the transmission of swine flu by closing schools, keeping children home from school so they could not transmit the disease in the school setting. This has actually some major consequences if you think about it. If you are the parents of children in elementary school or such an age where they're not able to stay at home without supervision, one or more of the parents must stay home and supervise them. And this has consequences for the family income as well as for the employers of the parents. In addition, in Mexico, for example, when the swine flu broke out down there, the president, President Vicente Fox, told the children in schools in Mexico to do two things. The president said, first, don't come to school, and number two, stay at home. Well, the children were very happy to obey the president's first directive, not go to school, but they didn't comply so well with the stay at home. In fact, they saw it as a day off, and many of them went to the shopping malls and mixed it up with the other children. So there was a spread of disease that was not expected. There was actually a spike of infection following the president's order. And third, a lesson learned was that the international coordination, that is the transmission between countries, the bilateral agreements, this can be very complicated. Many of the countries had had agreements between each other, bilaterally or regionally, as to how they would assist their neighbors in the event of a large-scale epidemic of disease. In fact, when the disease breaks out, countries will and should look after their domestic issues, their own populations first. If that means that they can no longer provide assistance to their neighbors, that's just what they're going to do. And so you must ask yourself, what are your options? What would you do? What would your country do if you had been promised assistance by your neighbor and then the neighbor reneged on that promise? They said, I'm sorry, we just can't help you. What would you do? These are discussions that need to be made well in advance, because even though you can surge more doctors, more hospital beds, more medications, trust and cooperation cannot be surged. I've spoken about H5N1 bird flu and H1N1 swine flu, but there is a new flu out there that's surfaced in southern China, and its designation is H7N9. And the question I ask, H7N9, this new flu, should the world be concerned? My answer is yes. And this is the reason why. First and foremost, it's a very dangerous disease. The case fatality rate for H7N9 is 26%. That means that out of every 100 people who contract H7N9, 26 will die. For comparison and for context, the 1918 flu virus that killed 50 million people around the world in 1918 had a case fatality rate of only 2.5%. one-tenth of the case fatality rate of H7N9. The seasonal flu that you get your shot for each year has a case fatality rate of only 0.1%. Only 1 of 1,000 people would die of that. And then, as I said earlier, the H5N1 is very serious, killing more than 60%. But more than just the numbers there, the important fact is that with H7N9, this can be transmitted from poultry to humans, but infected birds do not appear ill. In the case of the H5N1 bird flu, if you have sick birds in your flock, you know it, because within a couple of days, the birds begin to look very bad, bad condition, and they die, 2 or 3 days from infection to death. This is not the case with H7N9. These birds do not get sick. They do not appear sick. Yet, they have the virus in them, and they're transmitting it to other birds and to people. So you can be exposed to the virus and not even know it. Also, the only drug that's available to mitigate symptoms of this disease, called Tamiflu, is showing resistance in this particular strain. And of course, there's no vaccine yet for this new entry into the flu market. This slide is intended to show how viruses, influenza viruses in particular, can change or mutate over time. Humans can contract human influenza, of course. Birds can contract bird flu, and pigs can contract pig flu. However, pigs also can contract human flu, and they also can contract bird flu. So what happens if a pig gets infected with more than one type of flu at the same time? What if it gets a bird flu and a swine flu at the same time? Well, what can happen, what potentially can happen, is that these two viruses, these different viruses, can mix together and form hybrids or mutants that would have some of the characteristics of one virus and some of the characteristics of the other virus. And what would come out would be basically an entirely new virus, one that no human on the earth has ever seen, and one for which no human on the earth has any immunity whatsoever. Think about that. If the mutant reassortant virus were to have the human-to-human transmissibility of swine flu and the lethality of bird flu all in one virus, this would be an extremely dangerous situation for humans across the globe. Now, just a few words about a typical flu and the disease features. I have them listed here, but I would like to call your attention to the line in red font. An infectious period, that is the period in which a virus is able to spread from person to person, may include up to 1 to 2 days prior to developing symptoms. And I'll explain that. If a person is infected with the flu, they will, after a few days, begin to have symptoms, neck aches, runny nose, maybe cough, this sort of thing. But for 1 to 2 days before they actually feel sick, before they actually are displaying any visible symptoms, they are actually infectious to other people. That is, they can actually be spreading viruses and infecting people around them when neither they nor the people around them are aware that they're sick. This slide I labeled an influenza explosion. If you look at a slide like this, if you've seen a slide like this of data before and you see such a dramatic increase in some parameter over time, typically the time frame is over months or even years. But this graph is a graph of the spread of swine flu in the United States, and it shows it over 1 month. This is just 1 month's worth of data. So on the left is late April when the first cases broke out. On the right is late May, 30 days later, and you go from 7 cases to almost 8,000 cases. And that's why I characterize this as explosive spread of influenza. The two graphs on this slide show you two things related to influenza, the 1918 influenza that spread globally during World War I. The upper graph shows you the number of cases, case fatality rate, that is the number of people who died in different age groups over time with the 1918 flu. And what you see when you graph the data are that there was an initial peak of this flu that was actually fairly mild, just like the seasonal flu. It came and it went, and people were relieved that this flu had gone. Then it came back. It came back with a vengeance at a much higher, much more lethal strain, which killed many, many people. Then it went away. Then it came back a third time with a sort of intermediate form, severe but less lethal. So there are two lessons out of this. The first is that the flu doesn't just come and go. It comes in waves. It comes, it disappears, it returns, it disappears, it returns. Flu comes in waves. That's the first point. And the second one is that when the flu came, in this case, the first time it was a fairly mild disease. It went away. When it came back, it had mutated, it had changed, and it was a much, much more severe form of the disease. And then the third time when it returned, it was something intermediary. And the point is that I think you can see the public health interventions that would have been put in place and would have been adequate and satisfactory to handle the first peak were not adequate for the second peak. It was much more severe, and you would need much different public health interventions, much more infection control. So the point of this top slide is that, remember, the flu comes in waves, and therefore you shouldn't have an early stand down, it's over. It's just not that way. And second, each wave can be quite different in its characteristics, particularly in its lethality. Now the lower slide shows you the case fatality, the number of deaths over time in different age groups. And what you see is two lines. The dotted line on the bottom represents the case fatality rate for the normal seasonal flu, the one we see every year, the one for which we take a vaccine, hopefully. The upper one is the case fatality rate of the 1918 influenza. When you compare these, what do you see? In the bottom line, with the normal annual flu, you see that it kills very young children and it kills very old people. But most of the people in between do not die from this disease. The 1918 flu also kills very young people, also kills old people, but there's an unusual peak of death for healthy people in the mid 15 to 50 age range. This is very unusual. And studies have shown there are explanations, technical explanations, I won't go into on this, but the summary of it is that this particular strain in 1918, for various reasons related to the virus itself, caused the body of the infected person to react extremely vigorously to the disease in its attempt to defend the body. And it is in fact believed that the body's overreaction to the disease is what killed the people rather than the disease itself. So it was a feature of that particular disease, the 1918 influenza. This slide has two tables intended to show two things. The upper left shows you the number of days it takes to circumnavigate the globe, to go around the Earth, going back in time. The graph on the right shows you the increase in the global world population. Now the population, if you go back about 150 years in the world, was about 1 billion, a little over a billion people on the Earth 150 years ago. Last December of 2015, the world's population passed 7 billion people. So today we have more than 7 billion people on the Earth. If you look at the time to circumnavigate the globe, go back about the same period of time, 150 years ago, and it took 360 days to go around the Earth. This was the days of the sailing ship. So basically it took 360 days or a year to sail around the world. But these days, with modern airplane travel, it takes about 24 hours. You can realistically expect to get anywhere in the world within a day or two. So what are we faced with? We're faced with a situation in which someone could contract a highly virulent, highly infectious, lethal disease anywhere in the world and take it anywhere else within 24 hours. And there's 7 billion people could do that. So we're faced with a potentially extremely dangerous situation. Now to summarize, I'd like to talk about dangerous influenza pandemic viruses and three characteristics that require to make it a dangerous influenza pandemic virus. First, it must be an influenza that can infect humans. The disease must be able to infect humans. Second, it must cause serious illness. And third, it must spread easily from human to human. Now with the diseases I spoke about, H5N1, H1N1, and H7N9, two of these three prerequisites have been met, but not the last yet. So let's review very quickly. With respect to H5N1 bird flu, which two of these three characteristics apply? Which two of these three apply to bird flu? Anyone? So if you guessed 1 and 2, you're correct. H5N1 bird flu infects humans and causes serious illness. It does not spread easily from human to human. How about H1N1 swine flu? Which two of these three characteristics would apply to swine flu? If you said 1 and 3, you are correct. Swine flu infects humans, and it spreads very easily from human to humans, but it does not cause serious illness. However, each new human infection is an opportunity for the virus to change. These viruses can mutate and form new strains with every single infection. This is an example of a different disease. It's a virus, but it's not a flu. It's not an influenza. It's called SARS. Probably you've heard that. How many of you have heard of SARS? Severe acute respiratory syndrome. This was a disease that broke out in China in 2003, particularly in Guangdong, southeastern China, and it spread to Hong Kong, and from Hong Kong it spread via air travel to the rest of the world, and within 3 months SARS was a global pandemic. This slide shows the cabin layout and the passengers on a flight, a three-hour flight from Hong Kong to Beijing. The passenger in black with a circle around him was a doctor who was infected with SARS. And this person got on a plane, flew 3 hours to Beijing, and in that process infected 22 other people on this plane. 22 people infected with SARS who then went on to spread this disease to many, many more people. And as I said, within 3 months it was a global pandemic. Now we've been talking about the morbidity and mortality, that is the human health impacts of SARS. But as I said in the global health security definition, there is also an economic element to global health security. The cost of SARS is listed for several countries in this graphic. And if you look at the top, Hong Kong lost 4% of their GDP, their gross domestic product, within 6 months. Think about that. 6% of a country's GDP in 6 months lost due to an infectious disease. That's an astonishing figure. Now, I mentioned SARS. I want to talk for a moment about a close cousin of SARS, which is still around, called MERS. SARS stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. MERS stands for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. These are very close cousins in the viral world. There have been many cases reported of MERS, particularly in the Middle East and particularly in Saudi Arabia. The important point is it has a case fatality rate of 36%. 36%. That's basically one-third of the people who contract MERS die from MERS. So far, MERS has been restricted primarily to Saudi Arabia and specifically to Mecca, the city of Mecca. There have been cases outside of that region, but they've been cases people who've been to this region, contracted the disease, and taken it back to their country in France or the UK. A big concern about this particular disease and the location where it's most commonly found is that Mecca is the site of the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Hajj, when tens of millions of pilgrims will come and stay in very close proximity to each other for a week. And the opportunity for spreading this disease is very, very high. Now, the public health officials in Saudi Arabia are exquisitely aware of this, and they take extreme measures to mitigate and prevent the spread of MERS because they know they're going to have millions of people coming in very close proximity in their country, and they do a very, very good job about it. But it is a problem, and we need to watch it, because imagine, just think about that, if there was a big outbreak of MERS in Saudi Arabia during the Hajj, and these people were then to return to their countries, to the UK, to Lebanon, to Finland, to anywhere, they would take this around the world instantly. This particular disease also has been shown to have a risk of what we call nosocomial transmission. That means hospital transmission. So people will go into a hospital for surgery or some other reason, and they'll contract the disease, MERS, in the hospital, and one-third of them will die of the disease. So this is a concern as well. I show this slide to you because when former President Bill Clinton was in office, he made the statement that HIV/AIDS in Africa is a national security problem for the United States. HIV/AIDS in Africa is a national security problem for the United States. Now, HIV/AIDS is not an influenza, but it is a viral infection, uniformly lethal. And when President Clinton made this statement, people were a little confused. They didn't really understand what he was talking about. If you look in the upper left of this graphic, you see a normal population distribution. That is, in most populations around the world, most countries, there's a large number of people in the middle age group, a few young people, and a few old people. That's a normal population distribution. In several countries in Africa, like Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, HIV/AIDS has killed so many people in the middle age group that the population distribution takes on a bimodal shape, as you see in the upper right. So what you're left with is a lot of younger people, a lot of older people who cannot supervise them, and all of the people in the middle, that's the parents, the teachers, the police, mid-range military, the productive people of society, they're gone. They're all dead. And so you have the young people who are sort of disenfranchised and on the margins, old people who cannot control them, and basically that's when you get people who are vulnerable to ideologues coming along and saying to these young people, follow me, we'll give you a better life. And that's when you come up with these tragic pictures of young people carrying weapons around the world. So that's what the president was talking about, is if HIV/AIDS gets bad enough and damages the population the way I've described it here, you can have it change from a public health problem to a political problem, to a security problem with public disorder and even eventually insurgencies and terrorism. And if that insurgency and terrorism gets bad enough and well-funded, it can be exported, like to the United States. So that's what the president meant when he said HIV/AIDS in Africa is first a national security problem and second to the United States. Does everyone understand that? So I'd like to talk just a bit about bioterrorism. Bioterrorism is something we hope we never see, but it's something we have to realize is a possibility. I speak of bioterrorism as a weapon of mass effect. Most of you are familiar with the term weapon of mass destruction. Weapon of mass destruction. You think of nuclear bombs, this sort of thing. Well, bioterrorism I describe as a weapon of mass effect rather than mass destruction because the public reaction to a bioterrorist attack is far out of proportion to the actual threat. Because there's so much chaos and confusion, healthcare systems can be overwhelmed by people who believe they've been impacted or infected by the bioterrorist attack. And I'll give you an example of that. In 2001, when there were anthrax attacks on the United States, I actually was working there at that time, and when the word got out that there'd been an effective bioterrorist attack on our nation's capital, within 48 hours, over 5,000 people rushed into the emergency rooms of the hospitals in Washington, D.C., demanding treatment for anthrax. They knew that they had anthrax. Now, the triage doctors in the emergency room knew they did not have anthrax. In fact, the reality is only 22 people were exposed by that attack to anthrax, and only 5 died. So it certainly wasn't 5,000. It was a small fraction. And all these people came in, were not going to leave the emergency room until they got treatment for anthrax. Now, the emergency room doctors still have all their routine emergencies. They have automobile accidents. They have obstetric cases, people having heart attacks. These are real emergencies. And yet, their emergency rooms were just full of people demanding treatment for anthrax. And it basically crashed the medical system in Washington, D.C. So that's why I describe it as a weapon of mass effect. However, it's important to note that highly communicable agents such as smallpox and plague, if they were to be employed as biological attack agents, they would constitute a global security threat, a global threat to health security because they are so communicable and because of modern airline transportation. In addition, people could try to modify these organisms to make them more dangerous, more lethal, or more harder to detect. And this is possible through genetic engineering. And finally, we've been talking primarily about infectious diseases and their impacts on humans, but you also have to think about the economic impacts and how that impacts security. Food, agroterrorism, as we call it. You can make biological agents that will attack animals, kill livestock, that will destroy food crops, have huge economic impacts for our country. And finally, non-state actors, not actual employees of a country, but people who are described as lone wolf, for instance, it's very difficult to stop them from doing this sort of thing because there's limited effect of diplomatic efforts that you can put or international pressure that you can put on a lone wolf agent. If there were a bioterrorist attack, things would be different. And what would you look for? Well, first, you'd look for a large outbreak of a disease with high illness and death rate, very unusual. Or if you have a very uncommon disease like smallpox, a single case would be greatly suspicious. So any case of smallpox. If there's unusual symptoms or severity, or if the infection isn't normally found in a region, if it's a disease found somewhere in the world, but not in another part of the world and it appears, that would be suspicious. And the other indications that I have here would raise the suspicion that there may be some sort of a bioterrorist attack. Now I mention what is an improvised infectious device. This is part of a paper that I wrote a couple of years ago called Improvised Infectious Device, or IID. IID. You've all heard the term IED, improvised explosive device. Well, this is an improvised infectious device, or IID. And what an IID is, it is a person who weaponizes his or her body by willfully infecting themselves with a highly communicable infectious disease and then milling around in crowded areas, such as the Hajj, and then knowingly infecting other people with the intent to cause mass mortality, morbidity, and panic. So you can imagine if you had a person infected with a highly communicable, highly infectious disease in a swimming pool, on a subway, at a mall, at a sporting event, just think how many people they could infect in a very short period of time who would then go on unknowingly to infect many more. In this slide, it's intended to show that a pandemic is more than just a medical issue. It infects all elements of our critical infrastructure. Certainly, if there is an outbreak of a disease, it affects the public health and healthcare. The Minister of Health is primarily the point for this. However, it's far more than that. You also have impacts on our telecommunications and our transportation systems. Basically, any system that has people who can get sick is going to be impacted. Agriculture and food, if you can't harvest your crops or plant your crops, think of the consequences of that, both for health and economics. And emergency services, the people who deal with this, hospitals, ambulances, if they can't pick people up and treat people, this epidemic is going to get out of control. So the point is, a pandemic is a multi-sectoral problem, and thus interdisciplinary approaches are needed to deal with it. Now, countries must respond. They must deal when there's an outbreak of infectious disease. But this slide is intended to show you that typically the responses are what I describe as over-medicalized. Countries focus on the number of courses of medicine, the hospital capacity, number of beds. This is what they plan for when they plan their response. But I would argue that countries must also address the economic consequences. Disruption of manufacturing. Many countries have businesses that are dependent on what we call just-in-time manufacturing. They just have one day or 2 days worth of stock of the supplies to make their products, and if the transportation of these supplies is disrupted by an infectious disease, within a day or two, their business is shut down with tremendous economic consequences for them and their employees. You also need to address social dislocation issues. People may be restricted from gathering in public places, told to not come to school. All of these things can have tremendous problems. You could have the quarantine and isolation. Think of the isolation issues associated with that. And last, the psychological impact. I spoke about the anthrax attacks in D.C. Now, in addition to medical, if you do not have a vaccine or drugs, what can you do? Well, there's what we call non-pharmaceutical interventions. I spoke about isolation and quarantine, include school closures, also social distancing, just sort of as a rule of thumb. If there's someone who's displaying symptoms of illness, try to stay 2 meters away from them, just 2 meters, about 6 feet. That's enough that it's unlikely that they will be able to infect you from that distance. The World Health Organization published a set of books, a set of regulations called the International Health Regulations. These were agreed to and signed on by all 194 organization member states. And they agreed to comply with International Health Regulations, which are intended to limit the spread of public health emergencies of international concern. And basically what the IHR require is that if your country detects an outbreak of an infectious disease, it must report to the WHO within 24 hours of this occurrence. And then the WHO is supposed to come back and provide assistance if necessary. Well, there have been some problems with this, some challenges to this. Even though all countries agreed and signed it, many of the low and even medium income countries do not have the resources to conduct the extended surveillance that's needed to cause early detection, to allow early detection so they can report this. So they're just not doing it. And when they don't do this, they don't comply, it is a loss of credibility not only for the organizations, but for the World Health Organization itself. And the result is you can potentially have more frequent, longer, and more costly interventions required to deal with pandemics. So you'd ask, why might countries fail to cooperate during international health emergencies? These are global problems. It just makes sense that you cooperate with your neighbors in the region or even around the world, but yet countries do not. Why is that? Well, first of all, there is a potential for a serious impact of disclosure of your problem on your economy. And I'll give you an example of that. When the SARS outbreak occurred in 2003, it spread to the city of Toronto, Canada. Toronto is a modern city and a modern country, and they have a modern public health infrastructure, and they immediately did what they had to do to get this outbreak under control, to mitigate it and intervene. And as they're required to by the international health regulations, they reported this to the WHO. So when Toronto put in their public health measures to stop this epidemic and reported it as they're required to, what did the WHO do? Well, what the WHO did is they rewarded Toronto with a travel advisory telling the world, do not go to Toronto. And that had an immediate crushing effect on the economy of the city. Hotels were booked at 10%, restaurants are empty. It cost $5 million and 6 months for Toronto to recover from this. Why is this important? Because if you're a poor country somewhere else in the world and you observed what happened in Toronto, to Toronto, when they reported this outbreak, are you likely to report an outbreak in your country? Other reasons why countries might fail to cooperate: an aversion to international scrutiny. They just don't want the world coming in and looking around in their country for fear of what they might see. They just don't want that. Also, they're concerned about being stigmatized as that dirty country. And they may think that they can handle it. And frankly, there's legitimate national security and national sovereignty concerns. Some of the regional issues in the pandemic: as I said, the low-income nations frankly lack the resources for surveillance. They just can't do it. I mentioned earlier that nations may close their border or restrict transportation into or out of their country, and they may renege on plans, agreements to share resources, all of these things. And you have to ask yourself, what would you do? Would that occur? What would you do? So from an international perspective, epidemic disease can threaten national security, but it can also upset the stability of economies and governments throughout the Asia Pacific, throughout the whole region. So this is the international perspective that's of such great concern. And in the U.S., building health security supports some of the strategic imperatives of the U.S. rebalance, as well as intra-regional rebalancing. So when we speak of the U.S. rebalance, sometimes people don't realize that within the Asia-Pacific region, countries are also rebalancing in the sense of their relationships with their neighbors and others in the region. All of this supports stabilization, cooperation, and capacity building in the region. And this is important because stabilizing vulnerable areas in the Asia-Pacific region through improved health is a major global foreign policy imperative. It's not just a moral one. These regions may serve as a haven for terrorists and transnational criminals. So global health security is important for far beyond just health reasons. I want to mention on one slide the concept of international responsibility to protect, R2P. Has anyone heard of that concept, R2P? If a particular state is unwilling or unable to carry out its responsibility to protect its population, the responsibility for humanitarian intervention must be transferred to the international community. So that's what R2P is basically about. A country's first and foremost responsibility is to protect its people, and if it's unwilling or unable to do that, then the international responsibility comes in, and the international community is supposed to protect them. The international community must attempt to solve these problems initially by peaceful means, such as diplomatic pressure, even sanctions, but as a last resort, through the use of military force, through United Nations Security Council resolution under Section 7. Now, the problem with this, as I think you can see, is that this intervention, this public health intervention, even though it's well-intentioned, it occurs without the permission of the country involved, without the permission of the country involved. And I think you can see this is a problem from a perspective of national sovereignty, which is extremely important, particularly to the members of ASEAN. A couple slides about the diplomatic corps. When you're talking about international relations on any topic, including global health security, there's going to be diplomacy. Countries are going to have to talk with each other via their diplomats. So in the past, it was enough for a nation and its diplomats to look after itself, look after its own national interests. But today, in a globalized economy, this is just no longer sufficient. Also, no longer do diplomats just talk to other diplomats. They need to interact with the private sector, NGOs, scientists, activists, and even the media, since all of these actors are part of the negotiating process. Under health diplomacy, there's a need to address global health security more consistently at the national level by mapping many activities in global health across all government sectors and establishing new mechanisms of coordination within government and developing a national global health security strategy. Understanding domestic health security issues in a regional or global context must become part of comprehensive solutions. Increasingly, The optimal solutions to these issues will depend on what is happening abroad, and the solutions to foreign issues will depend on what is happening at home. So you can see the interrelationships here. So the challenge for health diplomacy, the challenge is that two types of imbalance need to be addressed as a priority. First is imbalances in the relative influence of foreign policy and public health experts. So if you have a foreign policy meeting attended by public health experts, they're not really going to understand the processes. And likewise, if you have a public health meeting with foreign policy people in attendance, they aren't going to understand the health issues. So you need to understand when you try to get these people talking to each other, there's going to be differential understanding of the issues. And in addition, you must address imbalances that exist in the negotiating power and the capacity between developed and developing countries. Think about Indonesia and Timor-Leste. They share an international border. If they have to negotiate on a health security issue, there's going to be tremendous differences in the negotiating power and capacity between Indonesia and Timor-Leste. And frankly, in a world where diseases like Ebola and now Zika are everybody's tragedy and everybody's health security nightmare, health diplomacy is in everyone's interest. So a few take-home points about public health security. Emerging infectious diseases, including bioterrorism agents, are transnational and they threaten global health security. Transparency is essential in responding to public health emergencies of international concern, and the bad example there would be SARS in China, where the word wasn't shared by the Chinese for many, many months and it became a global pandemic. So transparency is essential. Third, public health officials must prepare now for a highly virulent pandemic attacking in waves, as I said. Leaders must develop non-pharmaceutical intervention strategies in advance of a pandemic, because for most of these diseases, we do not have a vaccine that you can take to prevent it. And finally, multilateral, multi-sectoral cooperation is mandatory. It's far more than just a health issue. Thank you very much for your attention.